Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I am Tyler Bishop and alongside me once again, Shelby King. Shelby, you were out last week with the flu. We were just talking about it a little bit. I don't know if it was the flu. You were sick, some degree of sick, right?
I was some degree of sick and it probably was the flu, which is weird because we all got flu shots here.
I did not get a flu shot and I don't have the flu.
Well, look at that. I'm feeling a lot better this week, thankfully, and excited to do another episode of the podcast.
Yeah, I know our listeners are probably looking forward to having you back, although Whitney did a great job filling in, and I mentioned this before, but I could see at some point the listeners kicking me out and you guys just doing your own show at some point.
Maybe
a spinoff even.
Oh, wow. We would double our podcast production. I think that'd be fun. The first thing I wanted to start with was this article from What's New in Publishing. A recent survey from the International News and Media Association found that 59% of publishers spend less on engagement than they do acquisition. So it turns out that a lot of leading publishers do the opposite of that. So one good example of that is the Financial Times, which now spends 3 times more on engagement than they do acquisition. So the article kind of highlights that in order to be successful in doing this, you have to find ways to track engagement that really matters. So page views and number of subscribers can be pretty misleading. The Financial Times uses an engagement score based on a mix of recency, frequency, and volume to track engagement.
Interesting. So, yeah. I mean, this is obviously a topic that we talk about a lot in this podcast is engaging audiences. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's a principle from business that you can apply to publishing where it's, you know, the cost to basically keep an existing customer is less than to acquire a new one, typically. And this is, I mean, like this is a business principle that a lot of people try to understand really well. And, you know, if you're a digital publisher, when you think about the churn, I guess, which is basically your new versus returning visitors, every site is going to be a little bit different there. But the goal should always be really to keep as much of your audience as possible, meaning they keep coming back so that you don't have to, like, always think about, like, how do I create new content that's going to, like, get people to come to my site that have never been there before. So I think this is a really great way to like think about that maybe in another context, which is basically like how do you engage your audience? And we talked last week on the podcast about Financial Times doing a really good job with this in terms
email.
Of like email mm-hmm. and you know we had the newsletter example like how they were making special deals to students and things along those lines as well. So I think it's a great principle to stick by.
It's funny because one of my professors actually just sent out an email that was like, oh, did you know the Financial Times does this really cool thing with SDSU?
Like, way to be behind the times.
Right.
I'm way ahead of you. I talked about it on my podcast.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder what I'm doing there. The next thing I wanted to talk about was BuzzFeed, Vice, and Group 9 Media teaming together with a social analytics firm called Tubular Labs to create new standards for measuring digital media on Facebook, YouTube, and other platforms. So they're looking specifically into video. So Tubular Labs already gives publishers monthly rankings, which show which videos get the most views on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. But there's really no way to kind of find a definite answer on do those views actually influence people. So one hurdle to measuring video is that platforms offer different experiences for viewers. For example, YouTube viewers click on the video in order to watch it, whereas on Facebook it's kind of auto-playing on the news feed. So it's also difficult for publishers to get accurate metrics because even if a video has 1 million views, let's say, publishers can't really tell how many of those can be attributed to individual people watching or, you know, people watching multiple times. So this new initiative is hoping to give publishers a new way to look at their own performance and making it easier to compare how they stack up to their competitors. This alliance has only just formed and they haven't really articulated exactly how they plan to solve the issue. And they aren't even sure on what new metrics they want to create.
So this is really fascinating. I've spent a lot of time this week, and it's funny, my alma mater, I used to speak there a lot when I lived back in St. Louis, which is where I'm from. And I had one of my old professors message me a while back, and they were interested in if I wanted to come and speak to the class about attribution. And the reason why is because I have a very nuanced perspective on this and all these types of metrics. Because I think one of the things that we've learned over time is that user behavior and visitor behavior, even our most granular metrics, things like engagement time, dwell time, when we can really measure the granularity of how someone is interacting with the page, they're actively scrolling, they're in navigation, all this kind of stuff. Same thing with the video, like even the people that do the eye tracking software to see like where someone's eyes are at and all that kind of stuff. Even when you get into that type of granularity, like you don't know for sure. Like let's pretend for a second, like you and I watch a video and we're both watching it right now and we watch it the same duration. And for every metric that we could ever come up with, we both have to watch it the exact same way. But meanwhile, you're like thinking about the class that you have tomorrow or whatever else you have to do, and you don't pay attention to it. And I do, right? And so those experiences are very different. So now we're talking about something totally different, which is like the offline experience of your visitors. And this is why I think in terms of metrics, like you should always think of the metrics that you find. You should find some things that are true north. It comes back to the engagement stuff we were talking about earlier. But don't ever read them as like, this is exactly what happened. Good example of that is the Facebook views. Like, remember a couple podcasts ago, we were talking about there was a big, you know, everybody pivoted to video based on the fact that that Facebook basically showed everyone these hugely inflated video views because of that autoplay feature. Basically, anytime that a Facebook feed loaded and inside of that feed there was a video, it clocked as a view, even if that person never even scrolled down and viewed that video. And so I think that attribution is always going to be a difficult thing. Video is, it's growing. I think every platform is going to get better at it, but it is not an easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely going to be a long road ahead of
you, us. I think this is where we always talk about being data-driven, and I'm a big fan of being very data-driven, but I think you also have to really ask yourself an honest question of, if you're a digital publisher, and let's say you're investing a lot in video, and you get feedback from your audience. People say, hey, I love the show. Or, I mean, it's one of the things we look at with our podcast and our video series, right? We get actual feedback from people that listen or watch, and it's positive or constructive in some cases in a good way. And then we use that information. And you can use the data to basically say, like, okay, it's growing. It's growing. That's good. And then we're getting this feedback that's telling us this. And so you can kind of pair all these things together. But if you're seeing metrics for, like, let's say video that you're creating that look good, but then you're getting no feedback, you don't seem to get very much engagement or interaction, you should really ask yourself the question of, is this really something that is worth the investment? Is this something that's really engaging my audience? Or am I maybe being misled by some of these metrics?
Mm-hmm. Would you say that there is at least one good metric to look at right now? Or is it kind of just, like you said, mostly just look at the engagement?
What are we talking about? Video?
Video.
Every platform is different.
Yeah.
Facebook is the hardest one, in my opinion. I think you really want to look at engagement and just the feedback from your audience there, because I don't know how anyone else feels, but I don't trust Facebook's metrics as far as I can throw them. Google's probably a little bit better, but YouTube, they have a little bit more granular analytics, so I would say that YouTube... It depends on what your goal is. If you're a publisher that's really trying to grow on YouTube, I'd probably look at that subscriber number. That's probably the one that's most important to you long term. Otherwise, if your video is just supplementing your content, you probably are looking at views.
Right. The next thing I wanted to talk about is Glamour is seeking to build habit with a site redesign.
I know. I read that, and I actually avoided it in the newsletter this week.
Yes. Don't want to give anyone any crazy ideas. So,
I don't want to just be out on the fence and say, like, all redesigns are bad. But, like, most people, when they redesign their sites, even big, big brands, do a really, really bad job of thinking through just how it's going to affect things. And then people get really committed and married to them, and mm-hmm. then you roll it out, and then you see everybody organic rankings drop or bounce rate goes up, and then everybody just feels like, well, we invested too much in this. We're not going to roll back the site to the old one, you know? So anyways.
Yes, so Condé Nast. Is that how you say it?
Yeah,
okay.
Condé Nast.
I'm always butchering names. So they announced last week that they're going to put up a paywall on all their properties by the end of 2019. So Glamour is one of them. But before Glamour can put up a paywall, they're going to do a redesign and design a new version of its website to encourage visitors to stay longer, watch more videos, and shop more with them. So this new design will help users distinguish between quick hit pieces and more in-depth reporting. Videos will also be featured more prominently on the homepage and infused into more of the site's written content. And they'll also be deploying shoppable slideshow galleries. So Glamour's new editor-in-chief has admitted that she doesn't know how the redesign will fit into the parent company's paywall strategy. But the hope is that separating long and short form content will help Glamour develop clear signals on what kinds of content users want to spend time with.
So I'll look at this in both the skeptic's perspective and then also like the here's why this isn't stupid perspective. So this might not be stupid because that's a terrible way to put it, probably condescending actually. But the point is they have a lot of properties and they can probably borrow a lot of data from how other things have performed, and they want to basically diversify revenue away so they could put everything behind a paywall and then obviously have a store as well. So they probably have some really great data on what's working really well doing that in other places, and they could be applying that to what they're going to do in this potential redesign. It sounds to me like they're really trying to build like almost like an e-commerce app with content, which I'm trying to not put on my skeptic hat just yet, but like maybe that's what some people are looking for. Like they're looking for the quote unquote Glamour experience, right? I could imagine somebody on the product team there being like, listen, we have content, we have stores, like people want to live the quote unquote Glamour lifestyle. So we're going to create like basically an experience for them on the web. And we have some data that says that this is our target audience. This is the things that they engage the most with. So I can get there. Where I have a real struggle, well, and I know that probably this is the challenge. Condé Nast is going through a massive restructure.
Right.
And pretty much everyone inside of the organization is super nervous. Lots of jobs have been lost. Like, everyone is just kind of plowing forward with this strategy, despite the fact that it doesn't seem like there's a lot of internal buy-in. We talked a couple weeks ago about the challenge with people getting people to pay for written content. That's not from like a major news source like the New York Times or something that's another legacy business. It's universally thought among media types that this is going to be one of those things that like when pieces of Condé Nast are getting bought up across the space in a couple of years, they will talk about like, you know, remember how they tried to put everything behind a paywall. And it's a really bold move. It's a brave move. It would be really interesting if it did work out for them for the media space. I don't wish them failure. I wish them the best. I hope they succeed because I think it would just show that there's more. I think diversity is a really good thing in this space. So all the power to them. There's a lot of hurdles, though.
Yeah. Yeah. What if your users hate it and then they have to pay for it, too?
Yeah.
That's...
And then it sounds to me like a lot of what they are designing here is around e-commerce, right?
Mm-hmm. So
the comment that they made about, like, they don't know where that's going to fit into the subscription thing. So it sounds like we've built our business around a product strategy, and now it's going to be behind a paywall. So it's like, pay us and then pay us to let us sell you stuff.
Yeah. Yikes. Well, I mean, you never know. Could work out.
You never know.
Do you want to make your prediction now?
No, I'll pass on making a prediction, but... Let's just see.
Let's just see. The next thing I wanted to talk about was Google Search Console. So Google has announced that they're hoping to close out the old Search Console in March of this year, so just a month or two away. So here are just some features that will also be leaving. So crawl error reports in the API are going, but Google says you can use the index coverage report to get that information. HTML suggestions and property sets are going away without a replacement. Fetch as Google and blocked resources reports are also going away. But you can use the URL inspection tool for those. So those are just a few features that will change or go away, but you can get the full list on Google's webmaster blog. But just wanted to give some digital publishers a heads up.
Yeah, so hopefully if you are a publisher, what I find is most publishers probably aren't in Search Console as much as they should be. It's a good thing to monitor, but it's also where Google is basically going to tell you, like, for the most part, like I've heard a lot of publishers recently say to me, like, oh, I got penalized by Google. Well, if you don't have a message in your search column, Google didn't penalize you. If you've lost traffic, that's different. That means that your content doesn't rank as well as it used to. And that's a different thing, but that doesn't mean you're being penalized. Now, that all said, it's about time, Google. Like, having two search consoles has been a huge pain in the butt. Mainly from the standpoint of, like, you couldn't do everything in just one of them anymore. Mm-hmm. And so the biggest one, in my opinion, is the inspect URL function that's in the new one. It's there now. So for people that were going into the old one to have Google crawl pages using Fetches Google, you can do that now inside of the new one. So you just throw your new URL and then click inspect. If you just publish a new post and you put your URL in there, it'll say not indexed or not found. And then you can click on request indexing, and then Google will index that new page. So I recommend people do that. So if you've never, every time you publish something new, if you don't know this already, Google has to wait to follow links and crawl the web before it will index it. You can speed that process up by telling Google to crawl it by doing that inspect URL thing and then request it when you publish something new. So it'll be indexed by Google faster. Microsoft actually just did something where they're allowing publishers to submit up to 10,000 URLs a day to Bing, and a member of Google's senior team actually tweeted out that this is one of the most impressive things he's ever seen, because it's a lot of crawling power.
Right.
But the idea is that eventually Google and maybe Bing, this is the rumor, they would both really like it to shift to where they're not investing so heavily in crawling the internet, like, algorithmically, and they would rather have publishers and just all websites submitting their requests for indexing to them. And that way, Google's not investing in, like, wasteful crawling, and they can actually, like, take requests. So they think that that could be the future. It actually helps everybody because you don't have to wait on Google. The only difference is like you have to educate the entire web that they need to submit stuff to search engines to have it indexed. Mm-hmm. But we're a ways away from that, I think.
Ways away. The last thing I wanted to talk about was a blog that you wrote about PWAs, and I got to help a little bit on that one too, so that was fun.
Yeah, I'm interested in your thoughts. You put together some of the data on that.
Yeah. Well, the only surprising thing was that I just would figure that the site speed would be a little more consistent across, like, PWAs, but that wasn't necessarily the case.
Well, think about this. So when you're a web visitor and you land on a web page, and I think that's when, you know, I made the title of the post was something like, what's PWA? Do they make your site faster? And do they rank better in Google? And the answer to the question, do they make your site faster? The answer is kind of. Like, it depends, mm-hmm. right? And the it depends part mean is when someone lands on your website for the first time, if it's fast or not, it's going to be just as fast and maybe slower than your normal mobile website. Meaning, like, if you have a slow site now or you have a mediumly fast site or whatever, all those same issues that are causing your site to potentially be slower are going to exist to the same degree. There's nothing you can do about it without just doing the normal things you can do to speed up your site. After the service worker installs the PWA in the background, navigating from page to page is going to be lightning fast, like an app. So once they're on your site, it's going to be way, way faster after that service worker has installed the PWA. But before that, it's not going to be any faster. I think we obsess about speed way too much, but I do think it can provide a way better experience, which is why I think it will help some publishers rank better over time organically for a lot of keywords. And the reason being is that once people are in the PWA, direct traffic is a organic signal. So if people save your site to the home screen or you're able to push them notifications because they have downloaded your progressive web app, which it installs automatically in the background, you can get more direct traffic. So that in of itself is like one thing we know for sure, like, is going to affect organic rankings. And so there's potential there. But I think the biggest one is probably the user experience, right? So if page view to page view, the site is very snappy and it functions like an app and you have full screen mode. We've seen so far in early data that those experiences are more immersive, less bounces, more page views, which generally leads to kind of this big idea that Google has internally, which they call search satisfaction, which basically means when you search something and you click on a result, what happens next? Like, does Google see you again? Like, do you come back to the SERP and click on something else? Do you then search something else? Like, Google like grades itself on like how good of a job did we do at like satisfying this person's like
query.
Yeah, so if they never see you again and they find out that you were on another site and visited three pages and were on it for 4.5 minutes and they see that that's like a really average experience, they're probably like, oh good, we're doing a good job here. So I think PWA is really cool. And they are probably going to be something you see all major brand publishers have in the future. There's a billion reasons why you should have one, but...
Mm-hmm. How long do you think it'll take for it to kind of trickle down into the mid or smaller level publishers?
I'm really bad about this because I was not hot on the trail. I thought it was going to be hard to get the average webmaster website to get really interested in this. But Google has pushed it so hard here recently, and they've included it in Lighthouse reports that I think even people that don't know what they are, they see a thing in the report says yes, no, PWA, and they're like, I think I need that. And then I think we're going to have infrastructure here that makes it fairly easy for people to do. If you're a Zoic user and you use WordPress, it's available. You can use a free converter right now. So I think there'll be more of that kind of stuff. So. I think it'll be fairly popular. I think we'll see the trickle down this year among the early adopters, and then over the next few years, I think it'll be very common.
That's all I have for this week.
Well, it's been great having you back, Shelby. This is a fun one, just from the standpoint of a lot of these news stories are the, you know, I said it on the last podcast, but you surprise me with these stories most of the time, and we decided that's the best way to do it. But all these have been ones that I personally like, kind of like, latched onto. The one I actually sent you before this, you said you were reading, and Whitney actually had tweeted it out this morning as well. So we're all sort of on the same wavelength now, which is maybe good and maybe it's bad. Maybe we've got some groupthink going on, but maybe we're just really tuned in to the types of things that we think our audience likes, which is what we were talking about earlier, and engagement. Like, hopefully you can know your audience well enough to know that you don't always have to go full data-driven to figure out what they want.
Right. And if you find a piece of content or have a topic that you'd like us to talk about, feel free to tweet us at ezoic, and we'll make sure to incorporate that into future episodes.
And be sure to check out Inside the Publisher Lab, our weekly video series alongside the podcast. It's on our YouTube channel. It's the Ezoic YouTube channel, but if you we have a playlist just for the show. So if you just want to subscribe so you can watch the show, you can subscribe to the playlist. So we want to thank you for joining us. We'll catch you next time on the Publisher Lab.